As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
The only way to score is, of course, to play with a hand break off.
Hello, I'm Ian Stone. This is Handbreak Off, the Arsenal podcast brought to you by The Athletic. It's Thursday morning, and as if Sunday wasn't enough fun for us, last night's game gave us a Casemiro booking, which means he'll miss the game at the Emirates on Sunday, and then a Palace equaliser to stop their momentum before it all got a bit out of hand. We'll talk about the implications as well as a general chat about whether anyone still has any doubts about Mikel Arteta and the process going forward. James McNicholas and Adrian Clark are here. Morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
So, I don't know if you heard, Amy revealed on this show on Monday that she wouldn't drive down Tottenham Lane on a North London derby weekend. she looked in the sat-nav, and one of the roads it took her down, wherever she was going, was Tottenham Lane. And she said, I'm not doing that on North London derby weekend. I mean, it's incredible, the madness that we fall for. But anyway, we were wondering what superstitions you might have and whether they've actually worked. James, are you a superstitious person in any way about the Arsenal?
I'm becoming one. I think I've spoken before, maybe on this show, about having a superstition where during penalty shootouts, I hide my head underneath a tea towel. if I'm watching
one,
on TV at home.
I was going to say, do you bring one to the stadium just in
case?
No,
I'm not a Newcastle fan. But I've got some other ones as well, which are developing. Like, you know the old thing of old touch wood, you know. But obviously, yeah. I do that during games. Like if there's a corner or a set piece and I'm at home on the sofa, I'll reach for and touch the coffee table. But I was at Spurs at White Hart Lane in the press box and all the surrounding furniture is plastic or metal. So I was in a real flap. I resorted to touching my skull. So I think the other writers around me were like, what is this guy doing? But every time Tottenham had a set piece or had the ball in within 30 yards of our goal, I would be just sort of tapping my skull rhythmically like that. And it worked perfectly. Aaron Ramsdale has me to thank. I'm a nervous wreck at the moment during games. During the Newcastle game, every time they had a set piece, I basically had to not watch. It's tough. It's tough being me right now, as well as it's going.
and would it be okay if anyone's near the press box and there's a free kick for the opposition for someone to come along and touch your skull if they can like reach over?
You're all welcome to touch my skull. It's exposed to the world now, so yeah, come and have a grab of it whenever you like.
As they get a free kick, touch a skull, quick, touch a skull. Anyway, what about Adrian? I mean, I had no idea I was podcasting with people from the 15th century. I genuinely didn't. Adrian, what about you? Got any?
Look, I went through the entire repertoire as a player and realised that none worked.
No,
so I'm out.
At all.
I'm out of it. I've tried a lot as a player, but yeah, various pre-match routines and boots on, you know, left boot, then right boot, left shin pad, right, you know, all that nonsense. Yeah, tried it all, but you know they don't work, right? James?
No, it doesn't influence. You say that, Adrian, but what I would say is look at the results.
Yeah. I mean, Newcastle did not score from a set piece.
Newcastle did not score from a set piece.
And you know how good they are at set pieces.
This
Adrian.
Is true. I have told this before, but Martin Margotson, who's the England goalie coach, was a good mate of mine at Southend United, and he was very superstitious, and we used to get a lift in together. And once he was driving, he had a thing about the Magpies. And when he saw one, obviously he had to salute it, did he, and say, "Morning, Mr. Magpie, how's your wife and children?" Which is just weird. Anyway, but he couldn't handle, what? On a match day, he couldn't handle seeing one on its own.
Sorrow,
he had to,
sorrow.
He had to seek out a second.
Yeah, of course.
And I remember once, he wouldn't go straight to the ground until he found another magpie to see. And we were driving around, we were like, mate, we're going to get fined. We're going to be late for the game. He's like, I don't care. I need to see a second one. So it's just absolutely bonkers, isn't it?
Can I ask, did he find a second magpie?
I don't think
And what was the result?
I think we lost.
You lost.
Yeah,
well,
I think you're
one
right.
For sorrow. There you go. Yeah. We all know the magpie tune. I have to say, by the way, I find it weird to ask this question because I am not a superstitious person in any way, which is why I've been happy to talk up our title credentials on this podcast before anyone else, right? And I'm just getting loads of people saying, oh, stop it. Although one or two people, I did get a direct message from someone, I won't give his name because it was a direct message, saying that he's a religious Arsenal fan and he appreciates my faith in what Mikel Arteta and the boys are doing. And he said, keep going with it, okay? So I appreciate that.
The only thing, I'm not superstitious at all now, but the only thing is about tempting fate. That is the thing that I do.
Sorry.
That is on
sorry,
my mind.
Yeah. Sorry, can I just say, you can't say a sentence like, I'm not superstitious at all, but the only thing I do think is about tempting fate. Because that, by the way, Adrian, is superstition. Can I just say to you?
Okay.
Is it
but that might just be sort of professional concern. You know, if you say about a player, oh, they're in imperious form, they've not made a mistake for months and months, and then next week, you know, they chuck one in their own net or whatever it is, then it can rebound on you and people say, well, you know, you did say that last week. So that might just be a professional rather than superstitious.
Well, then, in that case, I was responsible for Mudryk not signing because I thought it was a done deal. And I said so pretty much on this podcast. But anyway, sorry about that.
When I lose a duel, I'm upset. When I lose the small side of the games, I'm upset. Because that's the fucking standard. Because you come here and know you fucking lose.
James, you've written a piece about the end, well, I say the end, but the end for the moment of the Arteta out movement and hashtag, essentially interviewing people who got it wrong. You wouldn't have been short of interviewees, I would have thought, because pretty much everyone, as far as I can tell, had reservations about him. I mean, when did yours start to kick in, James? And I'm assuming you did have reservations about Mikel Arteta.
I did, but I think I was... I mean, it was impossible not to, I think, in that run of, you know, the winter of 2020 when, you know, Arsenal went quite a long time without a Premier League win and they were playing quite a rigid system at that time. The football wasn't great to watch. The results weren't much better.
No.
I think you had to have a degree of concern at that point in time. I don't think I ever lost faith quite as dramatically as some. I don't think I would have ever been quite in that Arteta out camp. But I think a lot of the worries at that point in time were reasonable. And there wasn't a track record for people to fall back on and say, well, look at what this guy's done in the past. And I think that's what's quite interesting now, actually, is to think, you know, was someone who wanted Arteta gone or thought he wasn't the right man for the job at that time wrong? And the easy thing is to say, well, yes, look how great he's doing now. But I think it's equally possible that some of those concerns were valid and there are things that he may have changed, he may have improved upon. It would only be natural that a manager right at the very start of their career would still be developing. And in fact, I've heard him say, you know, I've made mistakes in my short time as Arsenal manager. And I'm sure there are transfers, I'm sure there are decisions that he looks back on and thinks, well, maybe I didn't get that right. But what is clear is that the decision to stick with him by the Arsenal hierarchy was the right one. And they made that from an informed position based on, you know, the work he was doing behind the scenes, what they knew of him. And they have been massively rewarded because, you know, right now, his stock in world football, I would say, is incredibly high.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of decisions he's got wrong, I mean, maybe we could look at, say, Willian as, you know, something like that, a signing like that on 200 grand a week. But, I mean, Adrian, the fans did not have the benefit of the interview that he gave to the club, where I imagine he was incredibly charismatic and knowledgeable and knew exactly what he wanted. And they were all wowed by it. I mean, they were wowed by it the first time, apparently, but they thought, we need someone of experience. But we didn't have that. We didn't have the overall view of the vision that he had, which has obviously come to fruition, or coming to fruition at this point. So I think James is right, isn't he? That those doubts that we all had were perfectly valid.
Oh, totally valid. Yeah, and the football was really sort of stilted for a while and very difficult to watch. There were some really poor performances. I mean, so we lost to Burnley at home, didn't we? That was a shocker. The Villarreal semi-final in the Europa League, we didn't really have any ideas. You know, it was really nondescript performance. Even coming into the start of last season with a Chelsea game at home, the second game of the season, we took a bit of a beating there, and things weren't looking good. But yeah, no, I think I liked his steeliness from the word go, and I knew that he would have built up. He would have known what it takes to win, having worked at Pep Guardiola, and I think he got that across with his first interview about how he needed to do a lot of work on the mentality of the players to turn them into winners, and he knew what it took to get there. And I think what we probably didn't, well, what none of us heard in that interview, and I'm assuming this might have happened, is that Mikko would have had that vision, or explained the vision of clearing out the older players and bringing in a new generation of younger players, because that for me was the big, that was the big crossroads point. What he inherited, the squad he inherited, I don't think wanting to listen to him, didn't want to go, they didn't want to jump on the boat, as he described it. He needed players that were willing to do that. And it was just a matter of time before he could get rid of certain people to bring in players that were in his mould, both as footballers, but also as personalities. And that's where we find ourselves with the youngest team in the Premier League. Sat on the top of the Premier League.
Yeah. I mean, not only did I not want to get in the boat, they were basically holding it beneath the water, weren't they, really, to be fair. But, I mean, do you think there was any point when the board might have considered getting rid of Arteta? What would have happened, James, if we'd lost to Chelsea on Boxing Day? I mean, we were fifth, and 2020 this was, we were 15th. And one more supplementary to that, he only chose the young team that he chose because of injuries. I mean, we were talking about getting those young players in before that. I remember sitting in the stadium talking to mates saying, why isn't he playing the young kids? If he's talking about playing the young kids, play the young kids. Willian got injured. In came Saka and Smith Rowe and Gabriel Martinelli, and we beat them. What would have happened if we hadn't?
Honestly, I think that he would have been in a very difficult place with the supporters. But I'm not sure the club would have followed through and sacked him. I think their faith in him was so enormous. And if I think back to that time, you know, there was a lot of pressure and there were a lot of doubts being expressed and questions in the media. But the message that I was receiving from the key decision makers at Arsenal at that time was really consistent, that they really wanted to stick by this guy. And of course, there comes a point where it's untenable. And, you know, they reached that point to an extent with Unai Emery. But I don't think we were especially close, certainly from their perspective.
No.
And, you know, you spoke about faith. Well, they had an enormous faith in Mikel Arteta. And, you know, that has been rewarded. But I think it's an interesting conversation because, you know, you look at other clubs and they're, you see a lot of other fan bases citing Arteta as the reason to stick with a manager. You know, I'm seeing this a little bit in among Chelsea fans at the moment, you know, where they're quite unhappy with the start Graham Potter's made. And there's kind of a debate there of like, yeah, but look at Arteta. And what I think is really interesting is the question of whether Arteta is a model that you can emulate, or is Arteta the exception that proves the rule? You know, how many managers go through a period like that and then come good? Is it something that other clubs can learn from, or is he an exceptional individual? And obviously it's difficult to know the answer to that, because in football we don't really find out. Managers get dismissed. But in this case, Arsenal were obviously right to stick with it.
Do you think, James, very quickly, that having a bad patch as a manager inside an empty stadium is better than having a bad patch in front of a packed stadium? Because I think that makes complete sense. And I think Arteta may be lucked out in that regard.
I think that's true. But I think what Mikel would probably say is that the empty stadiums were part of the problem as well.
Yes, yeah.
Like, you know, for him, forming that connection and that bond between the supporters and the team has been a big part of his project. And he was not able to do that. And that is the other thing that we should consider when we talk about the early part of Mikel Arteta's reign, is the circumstances he found himself in, which, you know, obviously there was COVID, there was a lot of change at executive level. There was a lot, it was a tumultuous time on and off the pitch. So that may have contributed to, you know, his slightly unusual progression to this point.
All right, so when did he start to turn the fans around? Assuming that the board were on board and they were into it and they thought, right, we're going to carry this through and see what happens. I mean, the FA Cup win was fun, James. We all agree with that. But when you're finishing in eighth place and winning the FA Cup, that's Tottenham, isn't it? And no one wants to be them. Even Tottenham at the moment, to be honest.
No, I don't think the FA Cup was the launch pad that many hoped. You know, some of the decisions taken the summer after that, you mentioned the signing of Willian. I think on reflection, even the extension of Aubameyang, while it made plenty of sense at the time, didn't pan out. So, you know, you had that winter of discontent. The Chelsea game, I think, was a big landmark milestone moment. As you say, by luck or design, he kind of stumbled upon Emile Smith Rowe as a number 10. And a few weeks later, Arsenal signed Martin Odegaard on loan. And suddenly, the football begins to change. The emphasis of the team begins to change. And I think what was interesting talking to different fans is that everyone had their own kind of eureka moment, a time where they got on board. One thing that cropped up quite a lot, actually, I thought was really interesting, is a number of fans mentioned the documentary as quite an important thing. And, you know, Arsenal must feel pretty pleased with themselves about the decision they made to kind of open up their processes to an extent in that way. Because I think a lot of fans watched that and thought, well, I may not previously have been on board with this guy, but seeing his conduct behind the scenes, seeing his commitment, his ambition, I think that got a lot of people on board.
Adrian, what about you? When do you think things turned around? I mean, I mean, somebody in the article that James wrote cited the Man City game when everyone just went, oh, we see, you know, whenever it was, a year ago, New Year's Day, 2022, when we lost, but we gave such a great performance. I also thought Chelsea away a little bit before that as well.
Yeah, I would pick out the City game too, because until that point, he'd made us slightly more competitive against the bigger teams, the main rivals, but we were still reactive. We were still a team that didn't have the bravery to control the game or set out to really be on the front foot against the top six teams. We tended to sit back and counter against them. In this game, it suddenly clicked that we can really knock Manchester City out of their stride because we've got the players to do it. We've got the belief, we've got the hunger, we've also got the organisation. The pressing that day was magnificent and we really gave it to them. We should have won the game. I think everybody recognises that. It was quite a lucky win for Manchester City. So yeah, that was the day I thought, oh, okay, if this is how we're going to play every week, I'll tell you what, we're going to be right at the top end of the table and we're going to win these games that we've been losing for too long. So yeah, that was my eureka moment. And then yeah, obviously we had some ups and downs after that, but I feel that the way we played in that City game is the way we've played this season consistently, always pressing, always on the front foot, always looking to go and hurt the opposition and trying to control the game, and it took a long time to get to that point.
I mean, to be fair, there were a few people in football who saw it before most of us did. I mean, I saw Jose Mourinho's quotes after Arsenal were beaten by Tottenham in December 2020. He said, "I want to give good words and congratulations to Mikel because he gave us a very difficult game. Tactically, they are very good. They're very well organised. They were building with four, defending with five. I can imagine tomorrow the headlines will be about them not being in a good position on the table, but I believe with this players, with Mikel, Arsenal will be Arsenal again." Go on, Adrian.
Yeah, I, I saw those quotes, and I went back through my back catalogue of breakdowns. So I looked through all my scripts that I'd written, and I looked back at that game, because you forget that it's so much football. And the bit I picked out in the stats section of the breakdown really is interesting from that defeat. So final third passes, this is Spurs away, which we ended up getting beat by a couple of counter-attack goals. Spurs at home. Final third passes, Spurs 35, Arsenal 214. I mean, quite the difference. Open play crosses.
Was that a
Spurs
lot?
Three.
That was the one where there were a lot of crosses, weren't there, really?
Yeah, Spurs 3, Arsenal 32.
Yeah, but it never felt. Did you? It's interesting, isn't it? Because from my point of view, I watched that game and I remember Mikel Arteta saying, I think we did really well in that game. And I didn't feel that way. James, no. How were you about that?
Yeah, we didn't have that threat. We had a lot of, we had the possession, we had the territory, but we didn't have the threat. That's something that's obviously we've built on since. But the fact that we were able to go there and control it in such a way, I think, is what Jose was getting at, James.
Yeah, no, I would second that. I think it was the way in which we dominate. We didn't have the cutting edge, as Adrian suggests, in that final phase, but I think if you look at Arteta's team, there is quite an argument. You'd have to sort of step back from it. And if Adrian went through all his breakdowns, it'd be interesting to see. But it almost feels like he built it sort of back to front, defence to attack. You know, I think it was all about solidity and structure. And actually, what we're seeing in the final third felt like kind of the icing on the cake, if you will. It feels like he had to get it in place right from the back of the pitch to the front. I don't know if you've felt the same, Adrian.
Definitely. I think a lot of it at the back was to do with pace. We didn't have any for so long. And which meant that we had to play probably 10 yards deeper on the pitch. Right. So what he always wanted to do was be a pressing, high energy, high octane side that disrupted others and controlled the match in the other half. But because we didn't have the right defenders to do that, he had to work slowly towards it. So yes, and once he got the right defenders in, obviously then Thomas Partey was the big acquisition, and Ødegaard was then the next link man, and the kids ahead of him came good, didn't they? So no, yeah, absolutely, that's the way he looked at it. And I'd like to know if he planned it that way or whether it's just circumstance. I suspect it was part of some kind of plan.
And also talking about fan perception and, you know, the manager's sort of poll ratings, I think probably that kind of pragmatism, and Arteta's talked about this a bit, contributed to some of the confusion over what exactly his idea of football was. You know, he had an idea that he came in with, but he didn't have the players at his disposal to put that out on the pitch. And so he did cut his cloth accordingly. I mean, if you look at the way Arsenal won the FA Cup in 2020, it was playing a very different style of football to what they're playing right now. And so I think a lot of people look at it and saying, well, what is this manager's idea? Is it to do X, to do Y? And now it couldn't be clearer, but it's because he's got the correct tools at his disposal. It's his squad at this point in time.
Quite. Tim Cahill also, by the way, there was also a video of Tim Cahill at Manchester United when we won 1-0 in the middle of not a particularly good patch, and saying the key is Arsenal progressing because there's a formula to how they're playing, which exactly backs up what you just said. Roy Keane, by the way, wasn't impressed at all. I imagine he is now, although it takes a lot to impress him. But it does go to show, does it not, Adrian, that even a player like Roy Keane, who obviously does, you know, has played the game at the highest level and understands the game, still didn't see, you know, forget the fans, I don't put aside the fans, but the fans obviously don't know a huge amount about how these things work. But plenty of professionals felt the same way.
Yeah, they did. But at the same time, I think in those TV studio environments, sometimes you're under pressure to follow certain narratives, to, you know, create a debate. And someone like Roy Keane, even though Cahill wouldn't have seen Arsenal every week, I think to get a true feel of teams and the way they're developing, you need to really watch a lot of football. And I think maybe in Keane's case, he just hadn't seen enough of Arsenal to come to that conclusion that the formula was there. But we all get things wrong. I wouldn't bash Keane too much over that. He wasn't alone at that point. But yeah, no, I think from the first match that I saw Arteta, I thought, I like the ideas. I like the rotational positions. I like fullbacks coming into midfield and other players covering out wide. Little things like that, you thought, well, this guy's really bright. but it took a long time. But more importantly, it took getting the right personnel to make everything click into gear, and that's where we find ourselves.
Well, it certainly seems to be working, which is marvellous. This is Handbrake Off, the Arsenal podcast, brought to you by The Athletic.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
We were a bit with the handbrake at time.
Ian Stone, James McNicholas and Adrian Clark here on Handbrake Off. I should say at this point, I should basically apologise at this point because we're going to talk about transfers again. Although, James, there's been some developments. Fabrizio Romano saying that personal terms have been agreed with Leandro Trossard. That doesn't mean that the clubs have agreed a fee, because we know after watching Mudryk that needs to be sorted as well. And so far, Chelsea haven't made any move to hijack the deal. So maybe we should keep quiet. Decent player, winger. I mean, squad player to start, would you say?
I think it's an interesting one. I mean, it's interesting as well you say winger. I mean, yes, he is ostensibly a winger, but he's played a lot of his football for Brighton through the middle this season. And I think that may be one of the reasons that he's attracted Arsenal at this point in time. Because,
the adaptability.
You know, he's versatile. He can play off either flank and he can play through the middle, and he's shown that. He's a goal scorer. He's scored plenty of goals. Listen, it's not a signing that's going to excite people in the way of Mikhailo Mudryk, because I think there's an exoticism about someone coming in from another league, especially when they're younger as well, and a big price tag like that. They could be anything, right? You feel like this guy's potential is unlimited. With someone like a Trossard, we kind of have a sense that we know what he is. He's 28 at this point in time. We've seen him in the Premier League. But I think that there could be a value in that for Arsenal. He comes in as someone, assuming a deal gets done, which I don't think is impossible at this stage. I think Brighton won about £25 million from what I've heard, which, you know, we know from what we were bidding for Mudryk as well within our budget.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, they know that as well. So that might make negotiations a bit more straightforward. He comes in with plenty of Premier League experience, and, you know, I don't know how quickly this deal could happen, but you could chuck him into the squad straight away. It's a guy who knows the league very, very well. And yeah, I don't think he's going to be come in, and I'd be surprised if he displaces Martinelli or Saka at this point in the starting 11. But is that something we need or want? I think we need cover, competition, a quick fix, because Mudryk didn't work out. And in that respect, I can see the logic in why Arsenal have landed on him as maybe the one to go for.
I mean, Adrian, I mean, if he is, as James said, he's right now he'd probably be a squad player, but we can't be bringing in too many players to displace the ones we've got, because the ones we've got are just doing an amazing job. We just want to keep them fit and healthy, and but have someone to bring off the bench with 25 minutes to go if we need a change.
This is a bench transfer window, isn't it? What do Arsenal need? Yeah. It's if the first 11 get crocked, suspended, whatever, we need options. Or if we're having a bad game where something needs changing, that the manager can have the tools at his disposal to bring someone on that can impact the game positively. And I do think Trossard ticks that box. I really do. He scored a couple of goals off the bench for Brighton this season already. James is right about his versatility. 6 games as a striker this season, 3 as a number 10, the rest on the left. So he's not really a Saka, not really competition for Bukayo Saka. I'd say more so Gabriel Martinelli. He played up front and scored in that 4-1 win against Chelsea. He was brilliant in that match. He scored a hat-trick at Anfield. His last 5 Brighton goals came against Liverpool, Manchester City and Chelsea. So if anyone's worried about whether he can do any damage in the big games, maybe don't need to worry. But he's ostensibly left-footed. He's got a very, very good left foot. And yeah, I like him. He creates chances. He scores goals. The other thing to point out is that he loves a press, the Andre Trossard. Mm. He's all over it. Yeah. Obviously, Brighton play that way. I was looking at the numbers just before we came on air. He's won possession inside the final third 20 times this season, which makes him 4th of all the players in the Premier League, 1 shy of Martin Ødegaard, who's in 3rd. So we've got ourselves another player that out of possession, this is if he joins, of course, we've got ourselves a player that can go and press and be part of what we're doing.
And De Zerbi at Brighton has said that he changes the team, but he has to understand and to work with my attitude in my way because I'm the coach. I decide the rules inside the dressing room, only this. I mean, one assumes that if he came, he'd get on board. He'd be in the boat, wouldn't he, really, I think.
It's different being at Brighton. The thing is with Trossard, he's probably had whispers from his agent for months, maybe a season, right, of this club want you, this club want you. It's hard to focus fully on Brighton then, isn't it? I think if he comes to Arsenal, that the focus is 100%. Well, and I think you get on it, don't you?
Let's see. Go on, James.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, I think it's interesting as well. Well, first of all, what's said about a player when they're on the way out of a club, I think you always have to take a little bit with a pinch of salt because those situations are often difficult and
that's
tense.
Why he's leaving.
And players that agitate to make moves happen. Yeah. And that is a big part of the game, unfortunately. When it comes to sort of, I think there's a sort of a pragmatism on both sides here. Like, if you think about it from his perspective, he's 28 and he probably thinks, I want to compete for titles. I want to play in the Champions League. It's probably a big consideration. You know, I'm sure there have been other clubs interested. You know, there's been talk about Tottenham, talk about Chelsea, but you know, both those sides at the moment, that's not a sure thing in the very short term. No. And unlike a Mikhailo Mudryk, you've probably got a player here who is thinking in the short term. And I suspect Arsenal a little bit are thinking in the short term because they're looking at the next 6 months and trying to win the title. So it seems to be an arrangement that suits all parties. So, yeah, famous last words. We talked about jinxing things and saying the wrong thing on a podcast. But, you know, you could see this deal progressing relatively straightforwardly. And I think the pleasing thing from Arsenal fans will be, whatever your opinion on Trossard as a player, at least it appears the club have been pretty decisive here and acted quite quickly and reactively after the Mudryk thing.
Just a quick one on this as well, on Chelsea, our nemesis. We've got a good existing relationship with Brighton, having done the Ben White deal, of course. Don't forget that Chelsea stole their manager. Their staff.
Yeah.
Exactly. I know they had to pay for it, but there will be an element of resentment there. So, yeah, if there are any other Brighton players available, let's just sweep them up. I mean, I do like Caicedo as a Thomas Partey deputy.
Well, this is what I wanted to talk about. There's one other thing. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about Declan Rice coming in the summer, and I think pretty much the entire fan base would be unified in wanting him to come in. What an excellent player. But I've heard so many people talk about it, including people on this podcast. What happens? Do we just pray for Thomas Partey's non-injury for the rest of the season? Because, you know, he seems so crucial to the whole thing, James. I mean, what are we can't do without him in central midfield.
He is incredibly crucial, and you know, it's been interesting. There's been a lot of conversation in the last few weeks about Thomas Partey, Casemiro and Rodri. Those three players who I think have been probably the outstanding ones in that position in the yes. league. Some good news last night on Casemiro, which
we'll
we may
to
come to. Right. but he is, I hesitate to say it, but I feel he perhaps almost is irreplaceable in some respects for Arsenal. I'm not sure, you know, looking at the market, Caicedo is a great player, but I'm not sure there's anyone who can emulate quite what Partey gives you. I just think he unlocks this Arsenal team with his ability to control space at times single-handedly and to receive the ball in areas without a great deal of support where other players would be enormously under pressure taking it there. And he makes it look so straightforward. So I do have concerns, don't get me wrong. But on the other side of the coin, I just think, I just don't know who you can get that can do that job.
No, and who would be happy to sit in the reserves while, you know, while he plays? Because if he's fit, he's playing.
Pick up a title winner's medal potentially, you know, for
as that deputy, and get Europa League games and FA Cup games as well.
Yeah, on Declan Rice very quickly. If that happens, I'd be super happy. I don't want to be too disrespectful to the coaches that he's worked with, but you know. Think how good he is now. He's ostensibly worked under David Moyes and Gareth Southgate. I think the prospect of him working with Mikel Arteta has the potential to kick on his own game unbelievably. I really do, in terms of the ideas that Mikel would put into him. I just think his game could go to a different level. I really do. So if I'm Declan Rice, I would be all over this move. I know I'm biased, but I do think a lot of players like him will look at Mikel Arteta and think, yeah, I want to work with him a little bit, like players feel they can't turn down Pep Guardiola. I think we might get to a stage where individuals feel the same way about our gaffer, which is great.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask Adrian, I mean, again, it's a long way away and fans are probably more interested in, you know, what's going to happen in this January. But in terms of Rice, do you think if he was to come in, would it be to play in that Thomas Partey position at the base, or do you think he could play in the more advanced sort of number eight role for us?
Yeah, he takes up a lot of positions on the left. I think in the current framework, he'd probably compete with Granit Xhaka in that position. That's how I'd see it. He very much can go forward and impact things. He makes a lot of passes that go into the final third. I think he would describe himself as more of a box-to-box midfielder than most of us who just see him as a defensive midfielder. The other thing is that in certain matches, you just slot him alongside Thomas Partey and you have that sort of double pivot, don't you?
Champions League semi-final up against Real Madrid. You'd probably want
exactly.
two, wouldn't you?
There, exactly. Really. Okay. Okay. Let's not tempt fate, though.
I'm not. Oh, yeah, that's true. Arsenal v Man United at the weekend. Enormous game. I've never cheered a booking quite as much as that, Adrian. I've got to be honest with you. I must admit, although I did cheer more when Elise got that equaliser as well. But that was a big moment. Losing Casemiro, that makes Martin Odegaard's afternoon. I mean, you know he's got McTominay there and McTominay will try and kick him. But, you know, Casemiro, that game last night, Casemiro bossed that for the first 70 minutes. I mean, he was so on top of things. And to lose him, that's a big moment for us.
Yeah, I punched the air. Yeah. I did. Yeah. And the commentator treated the moment like it was a red card.
Now Zaha. Oh, Casemiro's gone in. This is a big moment. A lunge from Casemiro, a yellow card for the Brazilian, and a suspension for the trip to the Premier League leaders on Sunday.
That was my first reaction. He's like, has he got a red? Yeah. And it's like, oh no, it's a yellow, but that's fine because he's out anyway. But yeah, no, I agree. I think we've just been talking about Thomas Partey, how important he is to Arsenal. I think you could make that argument for Casemiro and Manchester United. So it is, yeah, how would we feel if Thomas was missing that game? We'd be on a bit of a downer, and I think that's how Manchester United feel. The players, I mean, were talking about it afterwards.
De Gea was complaining, wasn't he?
Yeah, but that's great, isn't it? Because it's getting into their minds ahead of the game. They're thinking, they're already making excuses for themselves, aren't they? That's the way I see it.
As a player, Adrian, when you hear something like that, if you're in the dressing room and you hear your next opponents talking like that, does that give you a boost?
I think it would. Yeah, I think I'd be a bit boosted by that, because I think, well, they're worried about coming here without Casemiro. Why else are they going on about it, and how unfair it is? So, yeah, I think it's a negative ahead of kickoff, isn't it? On Casemiro's influence and actually how improved they are as a defensive team, Manchester United. I was going through their expected goals against across the last 12 games, where really Casemiro's been an absolute regular. In those 12 games, their XG against has been under one, 9 of 12 games. Yeah. And, you know, that's I think tells a story. Prior to that, the majority of their matches were over one in terms of expected goals against. So they are going to be a tougher nut to crack, but less tough, you'd imagine, without the Brazilian.
Yeah, quite. James, I mean, they were the one team that's beaten us this season. I thought we played really well there, but we got a bit carried away at 1-1, didn't we? And then got caught with a sucker punch on the break. They know how to do that. And we are going to be attacking them at the Emirates. The crowd are going to be right up for it. We're going to be behind them. We've got to be careful not to get caught out again. I mean, they obviously talked about this, one would imagine.
Yeah, and, you know, we spoke about Mikel Arteta cutting his cloth according to what he's got. And I think Erik ten Hag has shown a capacity to do that. You know, he ideally, I think, would be a very sort of possession-led coach. But if you look at their victories over Arsenal and against Man City, they've not always been able to play like that, but they've shown an ability to get results and use that pace on the break. I mean, Marcus Rashford has been in scintillating form and is definitely still, you know, the major threat to Arsenal in this game. But Arsenal really owe United one, especially after what happened at Old Trafford. It's the one blemish on the record, really. And it's just a huge game. I think to win this off the back of the North London derby, what it would do for Arsenal's season, you know, this, it would be fantastic. So I can't wait, to be honest. And I think it's probably the, probably, I mean, Casemiro coming out slightly takes the shine off it in this respect, but these are probably the two best Arsenal and United teams we've seen in this fixture for quite a long time,
yeah.
I think.
I agree. Yeah, Sunday should be quite something. Obviously, before that, we're hoping that Harry Kane breaks the goal scoring record for Tottenham tonight and takes some points off Man City.
Go on,
as
Harry.
Well.
Yeah.
I'm not saying come on, you Spurs, on the podcast. I just can't bring myself to do that. But anyway, by the way, if you want some more Arsenal podcasting in your life, and why wouldn't you? Over on the Athletic Football podcast, Mark Chapman has been speaking with Amy Lawrence and Michael Cox all about Martin Odegaard. It is a thoroughly enjoyable listen. In fact, it's a little taster for you. Here's Michael talking about what makes Odegaard a unique captain. And first, Amy on the Norwegian's determination from a young age.
In fact, there's quite sweet detail about how, because of course a lot of football was a bit more amateur not so long ago in countries like Norway, Scandinavia, it's become much more professional since. Martin Odegaard's dad had, I think, some clothes shops in Drammen, and he would go to work at the shop and take young Martin down to the club and sort of leave him there with a packed lunch and a football on his own, and until someone arrived that he could play football with. I mean, he was completely obsessed as a kid with training and technique, and not just training but quality training. And he used to train on his own. He would train with anyone he could find, basically, when he was a kid. And apparently, even the day that he signed for Strømsgodset, at his first club in Norway, he was the managing director is Tore André Flo's brother, Jostein, who you may remember briefly was over in the UK with Sheffield United and so on, a big commanding powerhouse of a Nordic centre forward. And he said that he had doing the contracts, and Martin's like fidgeting with almost with a ball under his feet under the desk, and not really paying. And he was looking at the contract, and he wasn't interested in any other detail except the line in his contract that said that he was allowed to train as often as he wanted, because as a young player, there were limits about how often you could train. You actually weren't allowed to train very much, or weren't allowed to play very much. There was restrictions. So his obsession was that. And he went and signed the contract, and there was a noise coming from upstairs. The club kind of headquarters was closed. It was dark. And Flo was like, what's going on up there in the gym? And he went upstairs and there was Ødegaard in the gym on his own, listening to music, kicking balls. He just signed his first professional deal. So I think he had that single-mindedness and that dedication. And he still has that, but he just needed to find the place where he felt comfortable enough to really be himself on the football pitch.
But you look at those who have won the title as captain recently: Fernandinho, Jordan Henderson, Vincent Kompany, John Terry, yeah. Wes Morgan, Nemanja Vidic. It's still pretty much the kind of old school, the kind of person you'd make your captain in your Sunday league team, isn't it? It's the big lad at the back, yeah, who rules instructions on. So, yeah, it would be, I think, probably quite unlike anything we've seen before if a player like Ødegaard, who, as Amy says, in addition to being not a traditional position for captain, is not a real loud leader. If he can lead Arsenal to, you know, glory, not necessarily this season, but in the future, I do think it will be something quite different to what we've seen before in English football.
And you can hear the whole thing over on the Athletic Football Podcast now. Let's have a tune before we go. Adrian, I'm going to come to you first.
Yes, I've had a good think about this. It feels like we're going into battle this Sunday, doesn't it? I think two teams in really good form. That United-Arsenal rivalry is simmering again, which I think is great for the Premier League. And it's good for us, I think, to get the juices flowing. Feels like this match matters, and it hasn't mattered for many, many years. So in terms of going into battle, I've picked Seven Nation Army, okay, from the White Stripes. The reason I picked Seven Nation Army is because our team this season, our starting 11, has seven nations in it. We've got four Englishmen, two Brazilians, French, Ukrainian, Norwegian, Ghanaian, and a Swiss. And even if you put Gabriel Jesus in for Eddie Nketiah, we'd still be a seven-nation army. So we're going to go in to battle this Sunday with that particular battalion, and I'm excited to see it.
That's so you, Adrian. That's great. I love that. Well done. James, what have you got?
Yeah, that was expertly done. I'm not sure I can rival that.
Yeah.
And even if Eddie Nketiah eventually declares for Ghana, it'll still be Seven Nations because we've already got Thomas Partey. It's perfect. Do you know what? I've gone for I'm a Believer only because I had a sort of quiet word with myself before the North London Derby where I thought, if they win here, I'm going to have to start saying Arsenal can definitely do this. And they went and they did it. And so I am a believer, and I believe going into the United game, I think we can get the 3 points there too. So that's my song this week.
I love hearing people come round to this. It genuinely
my religious conversion is complete.
It genuinely gives me pleasure to hear this, because I said last week on the pod, we are in a title race, are we not? And Amy, although she didn't say yes, she did nod. I should point that out because the listener would not have heard that. But she did nod. And if we're in a title race, we can win the title. Of course we can, especially if we beat Man United on Sunday. We have been, they were talking on the Athletic Football Podcast about Martin Ødegaard. Choosing a favourite player this season is incredibly difficult. I mean, you could have almost anyone. But I believe that Martin Ødegaard has been the man. I'd love watching him play. So I'm going for a Joe Jackson tune from years ago called I'm the Man. Proper sort of punky new wave classic, I think. That's it for Handbreak Off for today. Thank you to James. Thank you to Adrian. Thank you to Abby, our producer. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the game Sunday. See you soon.